Great. All right, well, thanks a lot for the opportunity to give a talk. For those of you who know me, this will probably seem like a departure from what I usually work on, but in my defense, as Ken Wilson and many others showed us, the connection between statistical mechanics and particle physics is very deep and profound. And since we're here, actually, I thought I would take the opportunity to mention, even though Tony Z's not in the audience, one of the first books I ever started learning quantum field theory from when I was in college was his beautiful book, Quantum Field Theory in a Nutshell, which unapologetically takes the viewpoint that condensed matter and particle physics are sort of tied together and unified in the language of quantum field theory, and they should be studied together whenever possible. So hopefully that gives what I'm doing some semblance of an air of respectability. Now I'd like to acknowledge my collaborators. So they are Shamit Kachru and Jared Kaplan, who are high energy theorists, as well as Steve Kibbleson and Sri Raghu, who are condensed matter physicists. And the two of them do their best to keep us in line and make sure we don't do anything really dumb. You'll have to be the judge of whether or not they've been wholly successful. So I realize there's probably a pretty wide range of backgrounds of people in the audience. Some of you have probably been thinking about metals and Fermi liquids your entire career. Others of you may have tried to do your best to avoid the subject as much as possible. So for the sake of the latter, I'm going to sort of ease into the subject slowly. And you know, if you're someone who's thought about this a lot, I ask you to bear with me. And you know, if you see something you think that's important that I'm glossing over, you know, feel free to chime in. So just to go over some of the very basics, when we think about fermions, when we think about physics in metals, one of the major differences between physics in the vacuum is we now have this density of fermions around us. And as Pauli taught us, when we look at fermions at finite density, even at zero temperature, they don't all just pile into the ground state. Rather, they fill up the lowest energy levels due to Pauli exclusion, then they fill up the next lowest energy levels, and so on. And they fill up some C out to some finite energy known as the Fermi energy. And then the guys right at that energy make up what's known as the Fermi surface. Okay. And so what's interesting and important for the dynamics is you can have, so the very low energy excitations around this background are the following particle hole pair excitations. So for very little energy cost, you can go in and you can just pluck one of these guys right below the Fermi surface. You can lift it above the Fermi surface, and you get both of these guys act like particles. And they have, so this is very low energy cost. However, each of them carries some large components of momentum, which is the momentum associated with the surface known as the Fermi momentum. Okay, and so this large momentum plays an important role in the dynamics of fermions at finite density. Now, one of the remarkable things about simple metals, which was first proposed by Landau, and this is why these are called Landau Fermi liquids, is that these sort of surprisingly these particle hole excitations behave to first approximation like they're non-interacting. Okay, their interactions are very weak, and there are various ways of quantifying that. One way is that their lifetime is very long, so they have a very small decay width, and in fact it goes like frequency squared in Fermi liquid. So as you go to lower and lower energies, the decay width gets smaller and smaller, their mean free path gets longer and longer, and so to better and better approximation, they look like they're just not interacting. And this is, for a long time, this is sort of a puzzle. Why is this the case? You know, we have these fermions, they're traveling through this metal, there are all these other electrons that are around. Why do they act like they're freely interacting? And the way we would say this now,
PF and KF, what's the difference between PF and KF?
There's no difference. It's just PF is
yeah. Yeah.
So the let's see. So the way we sort of explain this now in modern effective field theory language is that basically all the interactions around in the low energy effective theory are irrelevant. Okay, and to my knowledge, this was first stated in effective field theory language by Schenker and then by Polchinski, and some very nice reviews. So I'm going to go through this argument. I'm going to show you how to think about the scaling and how we see how the interactions behave as we go to low energies. And we're mostly going to focus on this four-Fermion interaction, which, just like in the relativistic case, this ends up being the lowest dimension interaction possible. Sorry, say that again?
It's like a big interaction, right?
The scaling is going to be a little more subtle than that, but yeah, it's a four-Fermion interaction. In that sense, it's not very different from what you're saying.
No, but I mean the dimension is different in field C, right?
It's not a relativistic case.
Yeah.
That's right. The scaling is different from the relativistic case. Yeah. Okay. And in fact, the reason why the scaling is different is we're doing a scaling in a different way. Okay. So in the relativistic case, when we do scaling, we're always scaling, as we scale energy to zero, we're always scaling the momentum to zero. Okay. Zero energy is associated with zero momentum. And that's not the case now when we have this finite density. Right now, our low energy excitations are guys around this Fermi surface. So as we scale to lower and lower energies, we're scaling to a thinner and thinner shell around this Fermi surface. And the way that I personally find simplest to think about this is the way Joe first wrote down in his first paper on the subject. For any momentum you have, you can always just ask, what angle is that pointing at? Okay? And then when you scale to low energies, you can just directly keep that angle fixed, and you can just directly scale the normal component of the momentum to be small so it scales towards this closest point on the Fermi surface. Okay, so whatever the momentum is, fix the angle. There's some large component, which is the Fermi momentum, and then there's some additional component, and this guy scales to zero like the energy does. Okay? And one thing that's interesting is this: most of the dimensions of space are not really playing much of a role. They just become basically angles. And it's only this normal component that really plays an important role. So here's that same statement in equations. So this is the quadratic action. Here I've written sort of the integral over the angles of the Fermi surface. Then, and this is sort of just a prefactor which doesn't play much role in the scaling. And then I've written it in momentum space. It's a lot easier to think about how these guys scale if you write them in momentum space. And so we have the measure, and then we have the kinetic term, just the energy minus the velocity times the perpendicular component of the momentum. And so you see now it's easy to read off how things scale. Okay, if we have 1, 2, 3 factors from these guys, then to cancel it out so that the quadratic action remains invariant, the fermions themselves have to scale like e to the minus 3/2. Okay? So now we want to take this and we want to look at how interactions scale. So the lowest dimension interaction around is the four Fermion interaction, which I've written here. So these can now point in any of four different directions with four different momenta. And so it's a straightforward exercise to go through and see how this scales. Okay, so there are two components, one frequency, one perpendicular momentum for each of these guys. So that's 2 × 4, that's 8 of them. There's an energy delta function and a momentum delta function. And then each of these guys carries minus 3/2, so for a total of minus 6. And then one thing that's subtle that we're not used to is that the scaling of the delta function of momentum is a little complicated. And the reason is that for sort of generic angles, as you scale towards the Fermi surface, these are going to have some large components which stop scaling. You're just going to scale to some finite, fixed, large value, and this momentum conserving delta function doesn't scale anymore at some point. So what you have is 8 of these guys, minus 1, minus 6, so for a total of 1 left over, so this interaction naively is irrelevant, and it scales to 0 in the infrared. However, there's certain kinematic configurations where these large components of momentum actually cancel. The angles are such that all of the large components cancel. We are sensitive to the small components, and this guy can now scale like minus 1. So instead of having what we had before, now we have 8, minus 1, minus 6, minus 1. So it's exactly marginal. Okay.
What is the
a function of theta I?
What is v as a function of theta I? So these guys depend on angles. So in principle, this is a function of all the angles of these guys. Okay, because we don't have Lorentz invariance. It's not, this is not just a single number, but it depends on what the angles of where these guys point are.
And there is no impact of locality, or because even in spaces or can would be local then.
And there is a delta function.
Yeah, there's the delta function momentum. No,
but this delta function is overall conservation. I mean, a local in the sense that they interact when they are at the same point. Yeah. It would be like, polynomial local interaction.
Yeah, that's, that's basically this delta function. Yeah?
It would be special function of the theta, more, I disagree. Because if they interact only when they're close to each other, then the input of theta is also special.
No, you could. So to get an arbitrary function of theta, right? These guys have, these guys are pointing at different angles. You could have. Right. Well, let me just put it this way. Once you have some finite density, this is really the most general thing that's allowed, and so this is what the way you should be thinking about it. Okay, nothing constrains this to be a specific kind of function. Okay. Yeah.
So for these certain kinematic configurations where this becomes marginal, is it exactly marginal, or is it like?
No. Very good. So it's not exactly marginal as we're used to. It's only classically marginal, and in this case, we have to look at quantum corrections to see if it's marginally relevant or marginally irrelevant. Okay. And so the next thing that you should do is compute a one-loop diagram, and this is very similar to what we're used to, because of it being classically marginal, this has a log divergence. This is a very straightforward calculation, which is in many places in the literature. And you can do, and you find that there's a log divergence, and because there are two insertions of the interaction, it goes like b squared. Okay. So the beta function is just quadratic. I've just drawn b squared here. And from this, you can read off a lot of interesting physics. So let's start by asking what happens if if v is positive. So in the conventions I've chosen here, positive corresponds to repulsive. So the beta function is positive. That means the coupling gets smaller as you go to low energies. So as you go to low and low energies, this gets smaller and smaller and smaller. And even this one guy you might have had to worry about becomes weakly interacting, and the theory becomes approximately free in the infrared. However, something very interesting happens if at some point the coupling is negative, if it starts off attractive. Then the beta function is still positive, so it's still getting smaller as you go into the infrared. But now smaller means it's going from like minus 1 to minus 10. So it's actually getting bigger in magnitude. So it gets bigger and bigger and bigger. Eventually, if you flow into the infrared far enough, it becomes strongly coupled. Electrons bind into pairs known as Cooper pairs, and then you all have probably heard the story. These guys act like scalars. They can get BEVs, which Higgs the electromagnetic field, and then you get superconductivity. Okay, so this is the field theory understanding, the effective field theory understanding of how the DCS instability arises. Okay, and I think this is a beautiful application of quantum field theory. It makes sense to teach this to grad students in our quantum field theory classes. Yes, David.
So on the previous slide, B was a function of theta.
Yeah.
And so this schematic.
This should be broken up into partial waves.
Okay.
And you should have different equations for each partial waves. There's some subtleties here about. I mean, I could talk a little bit more about this, but yeah, but there's a different equation for each partial wave. Yeah.
No, but when it's run and it's still, when you know this bound state, it goes, then kind of it stops running, right? I mean, so it doesn't mean that coupling goes too far. For example, it could stay small.
Well, it becomes strongly coupled, and then you don't really know what happens in perturbation theory anymore.
You need to go to some, because if the coupling is even small, and this gap is small, right, there still would be superconductivity.
If you can find a way to show that you get a VEV for the electron bilinear, then that's sufficient. Yeah.
Turn back up to the question about what the locality.
Yeah.
So locality tells you that things are analytic at k equals zero,
yeah, basically.
But you're not, k equals zero is high energy. The thing that you're looking at across are k of order k sub f. So you don't, locality, that's why locality is going to constrain their interactions.
So I guess we discussed it today, but I forgot what the conclusion was. So is this like QCD where you don't really know what happens in the infrared, you can guess, or is this a computable example of not coupled?
Well, I mean, maybe someone can say more or less. My impression is it's like QCD, where you don't really know.
No. It's called
ECM theory.
Yeah.
When it works.
Yeah.
Is with the coupled.
It's like Gross DeVoe.
Yeah.
It's just a harmonic series, like a geometric series, basically.
Yeah. But it doesn't know it works.
Okay.
Yeah, but so in this way you do not need to go far. You start with weak coupling and you have a bound state and that's enough for weak coupling.
There's a strong coupled version of ECS which also works, Eliashberg theory. And it benefits from the same graphical simplifications, but you can't agree on photons.
So it becomes exactly large.
For large ratio of proton mass to electron.
All right, very good. So thank you. So there's one last thing about Fermi liquids that I want to mention before turning to non-Fermi liquids, which is the connection between resistivity and the mean free path. So this is a connection that is based on the simple picture that you probably learned in high school. If you know what the mean free path is, and then you can calculate the resistivity just by turning on some electric field, then the electron starts to move. It accelerates for basically one mean free path until it hits something. Then it, you know, ricochets and it has to start all over. Okay, and then from that you know what the current is, so you can calculate the resistivity. And the point is that the longer the mean free path is, the lower the resistance. Okay. Now this is interesting because you can turn this around. And if the resistance gets too large, then that means the mean free path is shorter than the lattice spacing. And at that point, this simple weakly coupled quasiparticle description wouldn't work anymore. And in fact, for simple metals, you do indeed find that this bound is never violated. Okay, so at very low temperatures, the resistance is very small. As you increase the temperature, the resistance grows, and it eventually saturates around so this bound is known as the Offrey-Regel resistivity limit. And there's some uncertainty, you know, is it the lattice spacing or is it the lattice spacing times 2 pi? But it basically works. And so this makes it very interesting that there are materials which, materials which do not satisfy this bound. As you increase the temperature, the resistivity just goes straight on through the bound and far above it. And so this indicates that these metals do not have quasi-particle description. Okay. So this brings me to non-Fermi liquids, which are basically things which are not Fermi liquids. So many, you know, the past couple decades, people have found many materials which are fascinating, which have properties which make them fall outside of the simple picture of Landau-Fermi liquids. So one of them, some of these properties I've listed here, they have things like resistivity that is linear in T over a wide range of temperatures. They violate the Offrey-Regel bound. Many of them have superconductivity, which occurs at a high temperature. And then the last one, which I'm going to really focus on, is they're often located near what are called quantum critical points. Okay, so quantum critical points are just phase transitions at zero temperature. So here's an experimental plot. The orange region is sort of the non-Fermi liquid region. But I want to draw your attention to the x-axis, which is at t equals 0. And what happens here as you go from, as you stay at t equals 0, as you dial some control parameter, in this case the magnetic field, you go from one phase to another phase. And so because this phase transition is being driven not by thermal fluctuations but by quantum fluctuations, we call this a quantum critical point. And you can sort of see the non-Fermi liquid sort of emanates out in this pizza wed region from the quantum critical point itself.
What's the color in the plot?
The color in the plot has to do with the power of T and the resistivity. Okay, so orange is T linear, and then away from orange is. So here you can see this, the legend. So orange is resistivity goes like T, blue, solid blue goes like T squared, which is the prediction in Landau-Fermi liquid theory. So I'm going to talk a little bit about why this pizza wet region is interesting, why you'd expect it to be interesting from the point of a quantum critical point, why is this region special? Okay. And this has to do with a second very useful thing that Landau taught us, which is we can learn a lot about phase transitions just by thinking about the Lagrangian for the order parameter for the transition itself. Okay, so for instance, if you're thinking about ferromagnetic transitions, phi can be something like the magnetization. The point is that in the order phase, it gets an expectation value, whereas in the disordered phase, its expectation value averages out to zero. And so you can think about this just by looking at the potential for the order parameter. In particular, if the mass squared is positive, then it's going to want to roll down to the origin and have zero bev. However, if the mass squared is negative, its potential will be concave down at the origin and it'll want to roll away some non-zero value for the bev. And then the point is, in between, at small or zero mass, is where the phase transition occurs. And so you should think of this point as being the order parameter is a nearly massless field. And what's special about this pizza wedge region is the temperature is large compared to the mass squared. Okay, so this is the region where energies of order the temperature, the order parameter appears to be a nearly massless field. And so you can think of it as a light degree of freedom. So as a high energy physicist, I'm going to take some lessons from the study of QCD. When people were trying to understand deep inelastic scattering, it wasn't clear a priori what, if any, local quantum field theories could explain it. In fact, there were many people who said that no quantum field theories could possibly explain deep inelastic scattering. Fortunately, a handful of people kept on working at this problem, classifying, studying local quantum field theories, and as we now know, in retrospect, this program was beyond wildly successful. The other lesson I'm going to take is that confinement in particular was especially hard to tackle directly, and a very important role was played by certain simplifying cases. So looking at 2D models, looking at large N, looking at supersymmetric cases, these all taught us a lot about confinement. Okay, so I'm going to use this is the philosophy I'm going to take. We're going to be looking at sort of classifying what can happen by studying local quantum field theories and see what type of behavior we can get. And we're going to look for simplifying cases where we can get some additional control parameter and calculate what happens. Okay,
but
so this is...
Yeah? But I would say that still, if it would be not experimental discoveries that it behaves like a free pattern, this original thinking that the unknown theory would be still there, right? So in this sense, it was an experimental hint rather than a... But you should remember that time very well, right?
Experiments are crucial, but they can't experiment.
Yeah.
Because at least can we go back to that experimental class?
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, is it known which class is this phase transition?
This is a ferromagnet. What do you want to learn?
Yeah, so what's the order parameter here?
The magnetization.
But then it's also some fermionic, rational fermionic operators present in this theory.
Yeah. So the thing that you would expect in this case, the order parameter should be something like the magnetization vector. So you would want, so you want your order parameter to be, what I'm doing is going to be partly motivated. Right? You want it to literally be something like this, right?
Yeah, let's work at it.
Okay. But I mean, it depends on the situation you're trying. So there are many different types of phase transitions. You know, this is motivated by this one class, but there are pneumatic phase transitions, which would be different. It really, they don't all have to be the same. But this is the one that I'm going to be focusing on. All right. So, and then the second thing that I'm going to do, which in high energy physics would sort of go without saying, is I'm going to start with local actions in the UV, and then I'm going to integrate out high energy modes. And in condensed matter physics, I think it's important to state this assumption. So what I mean by that is I'm just not going to write down terms in the Lagrangian like this, like phi 1 over box phi. Okay? I don't know that there's any reason why you're not allowed to study such theories, but that's not what I'm going to do. Okay? So
degree of freedom that you're
Yeah.
No, but in a sense, you have the, those tones, because once you load your interaction and you have exchange by certain particles, you do have one propagate of those.
You know, but you understand.
In this sense, it doesn't.
No, but you understand what I mean. I'm keeping those light degrees of freedom explicitly in the action. Okay, so if you were to integrate them out, then you would generate this. But I'm only integrating out high. I'm writing down local interactions. I'm only integrating out high energy modes. So, right.
Right, but in this sense, every seed is local. Because once you see something which propagates far away, you call it.
Yeah, yeah, I know. So if you saw this, you would say, you know, probably you should integrate back in that light degree of freedom. That's, yeah, yeah. But you understand the rules of what I'm doing, okay? Good. So this is the action that I'm studying. So we're just going to have the Fermi liquid theory, we're going to have lambda phi to the 4 theory, and then we're going to couple them together by Yukawa interaction, okay? So at this point, if you didn't like any of the motivation for metals, but you do like studying Lagrangians, you should tune back in, because this is just a field theory problem, which is well-defined in terms of this Lagrangian. We're going to ask what happens as we flow into the infrared.
Are
okay?
You going to assume it's a relativistic theory?
No.
Joe, you mentioned that this locality, if it implies local operator, it still implies large K, right? Large momenta. What you say, and here it is in a certain sense, it does imply this. Right.
Well, it's funny because for psi, high energy, low energy is large momentum, but for phi, low energy is small momentum.
Exactly.
And so it's a really funny, from a spatial point of view, it's a very strange combination.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anyone knows what the origin of this phi is?
No, I mean, the origin is motivated by the order parameter, but I'm not trying to start with the UV theory and match onto this. I'm just trying to write down the Lagrangian directly. It's just an effective Lagrangian, which I'm starting with.
In other words, I can ask, what is the size of this particle, phi particle? Imagine that it would be like a large size state, right? Then your locality is limited by, you know, kind of intrinsic size of this object, right?
If it has.
Imagine that.
Yeah, yeah. If it's a composite, I understand. If it has a composite in this size, then. But as long as the composite size is short enough that it's above the cutoff of theory, it has no role to play in this analysis.
Right. So if it is rather large, then it, like say could be large, right? Then it implies that your locality is limited by very large size.
Yeah. So I'm assuming that the size that we're always working below the cutoff of whatever the size of this guy is. Okay.
What is the motivation of adding an extra scalar rather than an extra pair of fermions, for example? What's the logic here?
Okay, so you could, that's also something interesting to study. You could also add some emerging gauge field. There are two motivations. First, simplicity. This is the simplest thing to start with, and so on. That's what I'm going to analyze, and we want to see if we can get interesting non-Fermi liquids in the IR. Okay. The second one is that the scalar corresponds to a possibility for this quantum critical point field, for the order parameter for the quantum phase transition. Okay?
I thought that the characteristic feature of the quantum critical point was that there was, well, non-Fermi liquids, there was no order parameter distinguishing phase transitions.
I haven't heard that. But there's no order parameter for it.
Because by the definition, if it's satisfied Landau's theory, then you would say that it's the standard one, right? And if it doesn't satisfy, then you would say that it's not this description is another parameter.
What is this thing that true is true for most of these quantum phase transitions, you do not have all the parameters. It's described by, you know, critical point is described by emergent degrees of freedom or. But there is no, you know, canonical order parameter which you can tune and do the same as the Landau theory.
You showed that magnetization was varying in these plots, experimental plots.
Phi could also be a
very
gauge field, which is sort of like.
And
it's very similar in a lot of ways. In a lot of ways, actually, very similar. When
yeah, that's true.
Emergent from what, right? I'm just, you know, psi has a clear physical meaning. Now, in BCAS, phonons also have a clear physical meaning, but they're a couple of different. now we have another file, and you're saying that you're going to study this without even bothering to ask what is the physical meaning of this file. You're in a microscopic degree of freedom, right? So it has to have some microscopic origin, microscopic freedom.
Well, no, I kind of want to avoid talking about what the microscopic origin of phi is and just talk about the macroscopic. But if you like, phi is sort of coming about as, you know, phi could come about because you have this fermion bilinear, right, and you can introduce, say, so phi is basically, say I have some four-fermion interaction and I introduce phi as a Hubbard-Stratonovich field. You know what I'm talking about?
Well, phi can be an imagination of some other electron. Phi can be some actual electron, phi can be some localized electromagnetization. It's like they can be different electrons.
Okay.
Right? I mean, well, even orbital. Okay. So phi can be some F orbital electron, phi can be some F orbital electron, you know, they're different electrons.
Okay.
So.
But you always get four non branch, right? And phi is exactly like this, right?
No, I think
there's a side by side.
No, no, it's a couple derivatives before four non.
Yeah.
Phi has a kinetic.
Okay. That's good. I mean,
phi has a kinetic term.
Yeah. Open, I mean, becomes massive one, generically. If it's not coupled the way.
You have to fine tune the.
Yeah, that's true. The mass is fine tuned at the critical point in order to make it light. All right, well, so we're introducing this phi field. Maybe there are materials which don't have a quantum critical point order parameter, and there are materials that do. So we're focusing on the case where it does. So this is an assumption. Okay. So one way of thinking about this assumption is we're basically marrying two of Landau's sort of great frameworks, is Landau Fermi liquids, and we're putting together with the Landau-Ginzburg-Wilson. So you can think of this as the marriage of those two, or if you prefer, the titanic struggle between them. As everyone knows, those are the same thing. And the reason why it's a titanic struggle between them is because the fermions are trying to renormalize the bosons, and the bosons are trying to renormalize the fermions. Okay, so you can think of it in terms of, so classically, the fermions get renormalized because they're traveling along, and they can emit a boson. So to turn that into a quantum effect, you can just take the mirror image and sew it together. So this is a one-loop effect which renormalizes the fermions. Similarly, the bosons get renormalized by the fermions. The classical effect is the bosons traveling along. It decays to fermion pairs. So to get the quantum effect, again, you just take a mirror image and sew them together. And this is a one-loop effect which renormalizes the bosons. Okay. So I'm going to talk about these two different pieces in turn. And a large part of the tension is going to be which of these sort of wins out. Okay, do the fermions or the bosons get renormalized first? So let me talk about the renormalization of the bosons due to fermions. And this is known as Landau damping. This is just the name for this diagram. So it's a one-loop calculation that's been done many times. And the way I like to think of this is sort of like a non-analytic math-like term, okay? So this generates something which behaves like mass squared. And because we don't have Lorentz invariants, this now is some function of frequency over momentum. And in fact, in general, it's a non-analytic function of frequency over momentum. Okay, so it's not clear. If this were just a mass term, we'd know exactly what to do with it. But since it's a mass-like term, it's not exactly clear. But the important point is, at very high energies, this is a tiny effect, okay, and we can work with it perturbatively. However, at some point, we get to low energies below this mass, and then it becomes a huge effect. And in fact, at that point, this becomes bigger than the tree-level term. And in fact, two-loop becomes bigger than one-loop, three-loop. Okay, so in that point, we can think of this as a strong coupling scale. We no longer can treat this guy perturbatively. Okay, and so a large part of what I'm going to do is going to be trying to find ways to make this guy small, to push the scale where this becomes important to be very, very low. Okay, so I'll come back to this several times.
Are you going
to
be interested in physics above or below that scale?
Above that scale, okay. Only above it. So that's why we want to make this as low as possible.
Sort of
first crossover from the ultraviolet towards an infrared that you're not going to access.
This is, so they're going to be other, yeah, we're just going to look for interesting behaviors that happen before we hit this, and we're going to try and push this as low as possible. Okay. So now let me talk about the second effect, the renormalization of the fermions to the bosons. This is much more familiar to us. This is just, there's this wave function renormalization. There's a log divergence here, and we know exactly what that means. It just gives the fermions, the fermion fields, some change in their scaling dimension. Okay.
What kind of propagator does the scalar have? Is it relativistic?
The scalar has an exactly relativistic propagator. The scalar is just, the scalar just lambda phi Lefort theory.
Depends on the kinetic term. I thought you weren't assuming relativistic invariants.
So the speed doesn't have to be the same as the speed of light, but because the only thing, you have omega squared plus some speed of sound squared times q squared, it's basically the same as the relativistic form. Okay? Is that clear? So, all right. So I should mention the sort of standard philosophy for how to deal with this is first written down by Hertz. The idea is the answer, you assume that the fermions win. Okay, so you keep 1-pi diagrams and you resum all of these. You feed this back in. So you resum all of these, you get a new kinetic term for the boson, and then you use this to go to higher orders and compute corrections to the fermion. Okay, so this is not what we're going to do. This is an assumption. It might be right, but it might be wrong. You're basically dropping an infinite number of other diagrams when you do this, which are all the same order as the diagrams that you're keeping. Okay, so this is an uncontrolled approximation. So there's a joke about this I learned from Steve Kibbleson about using theories outside the regime of their validity, sort of like if you are in war and your opponent is behind a wall, so you want to shoot your cannon around a wall, you just turn the cannon on its side. Okay. And the idea is cannons shoot in parabolic arcs, so turn the cannon on its side, you successfully defeat your enemy.
If you had n flavors of
fermions? Yeah, if you had n flavors, actually we're going to get exactly to that. N flavors of fermions is a way to make this work.
So, I just didn't get the previous slide, but you can make similar logic with the boson, right? You can have a diagram where a fermion renormalizes boson. Why do you conclude at this point that fermion wins rather than the boson wins?
I'm not going to do this, so that's exactly my criticism.
I understand, but back in 1976, they also knew about renormalization.
So I think it's not really, what I'm saying is not quite fair to Hertz, because I think he was considering the case where the boson was massive, and so he was just looking at the, he was just basically looking at the potential. So basically, because the boson was massive, I think the renormalization of the fermion would have been negligible.
If one particle is massive, you integrate it out. But is that all what you're saying?
Let me not defend some work that I'm not doing.
This came in, I think, when you're the Coulomb interaction, and particularly the longitudinal piece of the Coulomb interaction, if you sum this up, it gets, you know, screened out, which means the test charge will be screened by the metal, and that this was physics coming into that, and that seemed reasonable. At least that's my understanding of that evolved. But that's not well.
Yeah.
This is a different problem.
Yeah.
But it was screening for say Coulomb interaction, but for pi, it would not work that way, right? Because pi interacts kind of this particle and hole the same way, right?
Yeah.
But you know, some other reason he was doing this is he wanted to understand the critical behavior of the phase transition where phi goes from having an expectation value to not. And so, you know, what you would want to do is drive an effective action. You know, what's the effective action for phi, and just minimize it. And so, first step is you integrate the fermion down, and then he argues you can just take the tree level effective action.
Well, we're not doing that, so maybe we won't talk too much about it. Okay, so we're going to be looking for limits where we can do it. We just want to do the RG. We want to do Wilsonian normalization. So here are some limits we can take where we can calculate things perturbatively. So one that I'll talk a little bit about is we can take the ratio of the fermions to the bosons to be small. I'll talk about why that's helpful. We can also do epsilon expansions, which probably all of you are familiar with. I'm going to be choosing D to be the spatial dimension, and nice things happen close to three spatial dimensions. And then we can also take number of bosons and number of fermions to be large. And as David mentioned, if the number of fermions is large, then the fermions obviously win. On the other hand, if the number of bosons is large, the bosons obviously win. Okay, so this is nice because it immediately answers this question. So let me talk about why being close to three dimensions is nice. Basically, there's a nice coincidence, which is that all three of the couplings in this theory, lambda by the four, the Yukawa, and the SCS coupling, are all classically marginal in three dimensions. Okay, and so that means, so this one you're all familiar with, this is just the usual Wilson-Fisher, and the others are a straightforward exercise, which you can go through. And so this means that as we go slightly below three dimensions, we can run the usual trick for the fixed points in the epsilon expansion. So let me go through that a bit. For the lambda phi the four interaction, there's the usual diagram, and then it turns out that there's no log divergence coming from the fermions going around this loop. Okay. So as a result, this is just exactly the beta function that you know and love from Wilson-Fisher. So there's a balance between the classical effect and the quantum effect, and then if epsilon is small, you get a perturbative fixed point. Okay, so I think most of you know the story. A similar thing happens for the Yukawa interaction. Now we have two diagrams. We have the vertex interaction. We also have the wave function renormalization. And again, because this is slightly relevant below three dimensions, there's an effect classically. However, quantum effects want to drive it slightly irrelevant. And if you're close to three dimensions, then these two balance at some small value of the coupling. Okay, and this is infrared stable. The coupling goes like the square root of epsilon. And finally, the velocity also runs. Okay, the velocity of the fermions. So here is a summary of what this looks like. Here I've shown the RG flow in 2.98 dimensions. So here's the coupling, here's the fermion velocity, and you can see they're sort of all flowing to this fixed point. Okay? So no matter where you start, you always end up there. And one thing that's interesting is velocity wants to run to zero. Okay? This is going to be important for my very last point. All right, so we like this because now we have a scale invariant fixed point which we can calculate things in perturbation theory. Okay, so in particular, we can calculate what the anomalous dimension is for the fermions, and it's just a straightforward calculation. It goes like this, and from a standard sort of analysis of Cowan-Simancic equation, you find that the Green's function has to take the following form. Okay, it goes like 1 over omega to this power. One thing that's more complicated than usual is you have already in the two-point function there's a non-trivial scaling function. Okay. Omega divided by the momentum. This is the perpendicular component of this momentum. This doesn't scale. And so Cowan-Simancic doesn't tell you what this function is. But it does tell you what this behavior is. So that tells you that you have a fixed point, so you no longer have nice quasi-particles. All right? This is something that, for better or for worse, particle theorists sometimes call unparticles. Yeah.
L is what?
Momentum. It's this normal component of the momentum.
Shouldn't it be omega over L to some power then?
Not in this case, because right we're so the right, the kinetic term is psi omega minus L, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So those guys are both scaling the same way.
With velocity going to zero, that's not a worry.
Yeah, it's
equals
Z equals 1.
Yeah.
That's not quite the same as relativistic, but I agree. Yeah. Sorry.
The velocity scaling is to zero, and is zero at the fixed point? Does the fermion velocity?
Yeah.
That doesn't sound so physical. I mean, it's like a flat band almost. Right? Is that a concern, or do you just run it straight into that and then?
You're straight into it. I think it's interesting. I don't think that there's anything bad about it, but it does mean There's some subtleties. I'm not going to talk a whole lot about them. But once it gets to zero, now you would think there. You know, I've neglected higher order terms like you know L squared terms, L cubed terms. So once the linear term becomes small, you think the L squared term. Now you have to keep track of that. Depends on. It's an interesting question.
In the standard cosmetic theory, we also see that the critical quantum means that the last thing is in zero.
Okay, but then you want to put in.
It's a dangerous
higher
term.
Yeah, you're looking at higher order terms.
Yeah.
That's not. That's for the Gibbs Hiller gauge field. I mean, that's for the boson. Right?
Yeah. Well,
this is the Fermion velocity.
The Fermion
Well, though I think one does the scaling to keep. Doesn't one keep the coefficient of the L fixed actually?
No, we're keeping the coefficient. We're keeping canonically normalizing, so the coefficient of the time derivative is fixed.
Yeah, so that's I think that's different than what would be normally what has been done.
But if you have the near mass shell, then it will say that the formical level is near 1 to the station.
Say it again?
If you are on near mass shell, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Then formical level is 1, okay? Then it is function is function of given one foot.
Yeah.
One.
Yeah. But this is a Green's function that's not restricted to the mass shell.
No, of course, but then it's about calibral option.
Yeah. Yeah.
So where is the breaking of Lorentz invariance in that loop calculation? Is it in one of the?
Oh, it's already put in from the propagators for the fermions themselves, just from the very beginning.
The propagators themselves, because what you wrote down there looks like it would be just as linear thing, like a standard fermion.
The speed of even though the boson and the fermion are both linear, their speeds are different.
Right.
For instance. This whole, I would say Lorentz invariance is nowhere, it's completely badly broken. There's no approximate. The only thing you have is a z equals 1, but you don't have the full Lorentz symmetry. Okay. Is that clear? So, all right. So now let me talk about Landau damping. So Landau damping, one thing you find when you do this diagram immediately is there's no log divergence, so this is just finite. And furthermore, in the epsilon expansion, this gets pushed to a very low scale. So this is basically the picture we have. So at small epsilon, we have some intermediate regime where the boson is a Wilson-Fischer fixed point. The fermions get dressed into some dressed non-Fermi liquid with some non-trivial anomalous dimension. And Landau damping gets pushed down to some small scale set by epsilon. Above that, we know what happens. Below that, we don't know what happens. Okay. And I'm going to... I've also skipped over the BCS instability, so I'm going to sort of shove this under the rug a little bit. The point is that this sets in at an exponentially small scale, so if we start off with lambda size small, then it's only going to start running at order epsilon squared. And so it's going to be at a very tiny scale that this starts to matter. All right. So now I want to talk.
I just have a question. I mean, if you drop the BCS interaction, and, I mean, it looks like you've got a fixed point. And
yeah.
What stops you just taking that fixed point all the way into the infrared?
The
higher order terms you've left out?
Two things. The first thing that's going to hit you is that there's this effect in court. That at some point you're going to hit a scale where because of Landau damping, higher loop diagrams are more important than lower loop diagrams, and so you don't know what happens.
So epsilon doesn't control things. I mean.
Epsilon doesn't. The point is, epsilon small pushes this down, but it doesn't push it down all the way to zero. So there's always going to be some low energy scale where the theory becomes strongly coupled again, and you don't know what happens. So that's what stops you from going all the way down. But now I'm going to tell you how to push that scale all the way to zero by taking large n limits. Okay. And so the idea is we're going to introduce a large number of bosons. And if we take an infinite number of bosons, now we can actually get rid of Landau damping. So the precise statement is we're going to introduce two sort of SUN symmetries. and the n boson, we're going to charge the scalar and the adjoint. Okay, so there are n boson times as many scalars as fermions. And in this limit, as n boson goes to infinity, the bosons clearly win this tug of war. So this is a picture from the 1956 Shark Wrestling Championship, which Satyendra Bose won handily. The technical statement is that the Landau damping diagram is non-planar. Okay, so in the infinite n limit, this goes to zero. Okay, so now we've succeeded at infinite n, pushing this all the way down to zero scale. This is a technical point that we'll skip over. So the other nice thing is that all these diagrams that I mentioned about how BCS runs, these are all also non-planar diagrams. And so they're all suppressed by 1 over n. And so the only contribution to the running of the BCS coupling is the wave function normalization. And so it runs in the infrared to zero. So this theory is stable against superconductivity at infinite m. And now we can talk about, so the nice thing also about large n is we can actually make some statements not at small epsilon, but epsilon of order 1.
Let me say, at this, okay, so now you've got a fixed point or control all the way down to zero energy. And so the fermion's at zero velocity, is that right?
Fermion at the fixed point is at zero velocity, yeah. What's wrong about it?
Then zero energy excitation.
Yeah, okay. So let me try and say some words of how you might physically interpret this. So we're doing this all in the limit where there's this operator, let me call it L squared over M star. We're taking this guy, can you see this?
Maybe. Yeah.
I don't know if everyone can see this. We're taking this scale to be in the limit where this is infinite. Okay. Now, in the limit where this is infinite, then this analysis is exact. But if this is large but finite, then there's some point where eventually v is sufficiently small, and you're at a low enough scale that this term and this term are going to be comparable to each other. Okay. And the question is, it's really a question of what energy you're looking at. So if you're looking at frequencies of order L squared over M star, then you would need to keep track of this guy. Okay? If you keep frequency fixed and it's of order L, then this is negligible. And in the limit that M star goes to infinity, this is just zero. So the point I'm trying to make is if you wanted to look at what happens, say, on the mass shell for fermions as v runs to zero, then you would want it to keep m star finite, and you would want to include one of our m star corrections. However, if you're satisfied looking at the Green's function in the limit that I'm taking, where you're very far off the mass shell, then this analysis holds when m star goes to infinity.
When you include m star corrections, then v is also corrected.
Exactly. So the running of V, good. So the running of V is going to, it'll behave the way I said, and then it'll stop running once it gets to order, once M star times V gets, once V gets to be of order, the local RG scale divided by M star, okay? So if M star, in the limit where M star is infinity, it really runs all the way to zero. In the limit where M star is finite, it runs to the local RG scale divided by something very large. And then at that point, the RG behavior changes. Okay.
Why do we keep talking about one shell anymore? You said it's going to be a fixed point, it's going to be some anomaly dimension. So shouldn't we say, like we usually say in CFTs, that this theory contains no particles?
That's correct. This theory doesn't. This theory contains no particles. But, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, if V is scaling to zero, then one of M star scales to zero more quickly because there's an extra derivative, an extra power of K or L.
No, not necessarily, actually. So it doesn't. So in this case, the reason is, so the beta function for V is like a constant. It's like G squared divided by C squared. And so V actually runs to zero in finite RG time. So it runs to zero faster than any power. Okay, and whereas this guy is going to zero like a power. So that is, that's why these two terms can become comparable. But I'm really talking about, the reason I mentioned M-star is because you might care about it if you wanted to sort of physically resolve these things, but this analysis is really all in the M-star goes to infinity limit. Okay. It's like a heavy, it's like a very heavy particle. Okay. So,
if you go into this expansion, for example, you will get this. Let's say you start it from the generation, some expand
Yeah. All right. So, I wanted to mention. Oh yeah, I wanted to mention this fact. So, now, because this vertex diagram is non-planar, it's suppressed by n. And so actually all we have is wave function renormalization. And so the beta function for g, you can exactly write it this way. And so you know the anomalous dimension is exactly epsilon over 2. And this is true at any epsilon. This is true all the way. This is true even at d equals 2, for instance. So now we can have a reliable calculation of an order 1 anomalous dimension. And the Green's function still takes this form. Okay. However, scaling doesn't tell us what this scaling function is, but we have another tool at our disposal, which is that, as is often the case, when you have a large n limit, you have a gap equation, okay, which is that it's an integral equation relating the exact propagator to the 1pi propagator. And you can just solve this, and you find that the scaling function is exactly 1. Okay, so at infinite n, this is the exact Green's function. Okay, so. All right, let me make a couple more comments. One thing I want to emphasize is that these diagrams that the Hertz treatment is dropping, really, you now can go back and calculate them, and they have a big effect. So if you do 1 over n correction, you can calculate lambda damping. It's obvious this is going to be very different from what we had before. This now has, in d equals 2, has an order 1 anomalous dimension. Just the scaling of lambda damping is going to be totally different. So this is very different from what you would get otherwise.
Sorry, just a silly question. The fact that the L dependence dropped out of the Green's function, is that the same as saying the velocity went to zero in the IR?
Pretty much.
Okay.
They're closely related. So, all right, so now that I've criticized the Hertz treatment, now let me say some nice things about it, which, as David mentioned in the very beginning, if we take a large number of fermions limit, then it's exactly correct. These are exactly all the diagrams that survive, and then Hertz theory is really exact. Okay. And
exact of this sum of diagrams.
Well, the point is that if n fermion goes to infinity, these are the only diagrams that survive.
For the boson propagator, but then that feeds into the fermions and so forth. I mean, it's
so the point.
The vertices as well.
No, the. The point I'm making is that this diagram is zero at infinite n Fermi. Okay, this is not. Why is it zero? Because so we have. The problem is this coupling goes like g over root n Fermi, g over root n Fermi, g. All right, let me just go through it for the sake of everyone who doesn't see it yet. G over root n Fermi. You have one Fermi loop, so it's n Fermi. So the whole thing goes like g to the 4 over n Fermi squared times n Fermi. So it goes to 0. Okay. All right. So this is the case at infinite n Fermi. As you take n Fermi to be finite, now you have these scales that we had pushed to zero. Now they come up a little bit from zero, and you have, again, you have a strong coupling problem. This was In the infinite end Fermi case, this was pointed out first by Sun-Sik Lee several years ago. There's a similar, exactly the same problem as you take n boson to be finite instead of infinite. Now the scale that we had pushed all the way down to zero now comes up a little bit. So it's a very low scale. N boson is large, but if you really want to go to zero energy, you have to deal with it.
So that's the large n limits are completely misleading then, because they don't give you the. I mean, as soon as n is finite but very large, it doesn't get the infrared limit, correct?
Yeah. So I don't think it's obviously such a big problem, because a lot of the time you're not really interested in a lot of these theories. You know, the zero energy is protected by a superconducting dome anyway, so you're not necessarily interested in the exact zero energy limit anyway, right? You're interested in what happens in some intermediate energy. So.
But then your n is one. So, I mean, maybe there are, you know, physical parameters, ratios of velocities which are very small or something, which will help
you. What about dimensions there? G is dimensionless, or G is dimensionful in the upper case?
And d equals 2, g is dimensionful.
Because, but then you have two rings forming that. One contains one of m, and another contains proportional to m. So so you should have some extra dimension somewhere, right?
Yeah. Oh, maybe I got the dimensions here for d equals.
Yeah, it's what I'm asking.
I don't know. I can go through it and make sure that. We could correct it if we want. The point is just that, you know, this is a scale that has 1 over n in it. Okay? So your point, I think, is that, you know, real theories probably have n equals 1, and so isn't this happening at an order 1 scale? And so, you know, so the point I would just make is I think it's useful to study theories where you have a control parameter where you can really see what happens. Now, you can make the argument that real-life theories have, you know, n equals order 1, the couplings are order 1, so why focus on these cases?
No, no, but I just think, like, the ON model at n equals infinity, just for the ON model, that describes a phase transition which is valid all the way into the infrared.
Yeah.
And then you can do 1 over n corrections, you still have that phase transition, it shifts exponents to order 1 over n. So it doesn't change qualitatively the n equals infinity, I mean, n equals infinity and n very large or finite. Whereas what you have does, when n is infinite, you know, the frequency is always, it is never smaller than 1 over n, but as soon as n is finite, then there's a whole new, you know, low energy regime which opens up, which
that's
you're
right.
accessing.
That's right, that's absolutely right.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's different, very different spirit then.
Yes. So, yeah, at finite n, we're only talking about what happens in some intermediate regime, and then there's a transition. So, I'm basically out of time, but I want to mention this partly because it gets to your point. The last control parameter is you can take small fermion velocity. And this suppresses Landau damping basically by a kinematic effect. One way of understanding is boson sort of can't decay to two fermions if they're moving very slowly. You know, it tries to decay, but then these fermions are immediately not moving, and so kinematically it's just not allowed.
It's similar to large
n boson, sorry. So the point is that when the fermion velocity goes to zero, Landau damping goes to zero. Okay, and then you can just do the one loop computation and you see that this is the case. Now, it has an advantage over large n boson, which is that you didn't, you know, velocity is actually a parameter in systems, you don't have to introduce it. And the second thing is it runs to zero under RG flow. So it's qualitatively different from large n in exactly the kind of in exactly the sense you're talking about. There's no longer a region of low energies which you can't access, because if you take V and you push it a little bit away from zero, it'll quickly run back to zero. Okay, so there's no longer this discontinuity at very low energies between zero velocity and small velocity. So the point is there's sort of a basin of attraction for small velocity. As long as V is in this basin, then it'll run to zero, then there'll be no Landau damping, and then Landau damping will really be suppressed all the way down to zero energies. And you really have a fixed point over all energy scales. So anyway, thanks very much for your attention. I think non-Fermi liquids are a very exciting place to be doing work right now. They're clearly interesting dynamics, which we would like to understand. Our approach has been to look for local effective field theories of the Fermi surface, couple them to light states, and see what types of things we can get out in the infrared. Just doing sort of Wilsonian renormalization, we found there's a rich structure of such theories by introducing new parameters and by taking various limits of these. And in some cases, the theory can be solved, and you can find new fixed points. So thanks very much. Yeah. Okay, this is the fantasy. Is, you know, we know what happens at infinite n. We know what happens at this infinite n. What happens in the, you know, Venetiano region in between? That would be cool if you could. Well, okay, you can only calculate in these two limits, but there should be some interpolation between these two.
Yeah, but neither limit is qualitatively correct when n is very, very large but finite. So.
I think you're focusing too much on the strict zero energy limit. If
you know, in the velocity small you didn't, but here you're making up a parameter to push down some energy scale very small and then say, I want to be above that energy scale. Well, that's kind of, if that parameter isn't actually there, then it's just you inventing some big crossover window.
Well,
is maybe in your model, but it's not maybe relevant to.
I don't know, what would you say about the Fermi liquid fixed point? There's some fixed point there, but eventually you hit some superconducting instability, and so that fixed point isn't actually describing what happens all the way literally at zero energies, but it's what's describing what happens over some huge range of scales. And so I think, you know, if you exit the fixed point at sufficiently low energies, and you have a very large range of energies where it's as described by the fixed point, I think that's.
But there, the parameter is the Fermi velocity divided by the speed of sound, something like that. I mean, or the mass ratio between the, you know, atoms and the electrons. So, the physical system gives us a small parameter. Maybe it does for your velocity. I mean, typical, you know, symmetry breaking water parameters maybe are moving kind of slowly compared to the Fermi velocity. Once they feed in, that doesn't change that. But are you saying, so let me give you a very small velocity ratio. Then you're saying you can take this thing all the way to the infrared, and you have a stable fixed point, which is. And so, what are the physical properties of that stable fixed point? Like, what does the specific heat look like?
I think in general, if you couple together two relativistic theories with different speeds of.
Yeah, they can become the same.
In general, the ratio, there'll be a fixed point where the ratio is 1.
Yeah.
There'll be a fixed point where it's 0, 1 where it's infinite. And that's pretty much all it can be. So the one where it's 0 means that the theory that you have is not in the description, that it becomes a non-relativistic.
Well, you're missing some physics.
Okay.
Have you done any two-loop calculation, or is this so qualitative that it's not really very interesting to do?
That's the latter. We haven't done any two-loop calculations.
So the numbers you're getting out from this kind of thing are not numbers that you would ever want to compare with anything really experimental, for which it would be desirable to get higher accuracy.
Well, so I think we haven't gotten to that point.
So it was important for your analysis that you started to rate it from the Fermi surface. You started rating the finite chemical potential. While, for example, in ADS studies, one starts with the CFT, which makes sense, and zero chemical potential, then puts it at the finite chemical potential. So
yeah.
What do you think is more, like, in real world, what is the right way to think? Like, is your fixed point, suppose that there is some fixed point, would that fixed point be connected to some other fixed point at zero chemical potential, or does it exist necessarily only at finite chemical potential?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting question. You could also try, instead of starting with coupling two weakly coupled theories together, you could do something like informal perturbation theory, where you start with two CFTs and couple them together.
But you have to put chemical potential somewhere into the game.
Yeah. So you take some CFC, you add a chemical potential, and you see what happens. I think that's a reasonable thing to do.
But he does expansion of mass on the surface, right? So, so in this way, it's very different theory as compared with, say, with the heuristic case, right?
Yeah, I also think it may be that that's the only way to to proceed. That's only the only reasonable way to proceed. That there is no underlying CFT and zero chemical potential.
Okay, let's continue.
Yeah, actually, another project for us.